Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios Parts Unknown and FYP Studios West. Transmitting across the internet, this is episode 140 of Registry Matters. Larry, happy Saturday night. How are you?
Good, Andy. Thank you. And where are those parts unknown, just for the record?
For the record, if I had to tell you, if I told you, I would have to kill you. So it's covert, it's secret, it's underground, it's in the Great White North. I've crossed the border. I'm in the Caribbean Ocean. I'm somewhere.
I see. Well, I was just curious, if because I won't tell anybody if you tell me on this podcast.
Oh, okay. So I can tell you and no one will hear it at this point?
That is correct. They are suppressed.
I really think that we need to, I can't go around and kill you. So we're just going to have to let that one go for now. I'm visiting family. I'm up in the northeast area of the world.
All right.
We received an interesting little voicemail that I want to play, and we'll get this knocked out of the park. First off, this is from one of our new patrons, Tom. It's about a minute long, Larry.
Hey, Larry and Andy, this is Tom. I just wanted to say thanks for what you do and to let you know how I discovered the Registry Matters podcast. I think it was about 9 months ago I received a letter from the North Carolina NARSL chapter about what they and the National NARSL organization were all about. At that time, I really had no idea such an organization existed. But I finally logged into the North Carolina NARSL site and I became a contributing member, I think about 5 or so weeks ago. About a week and a half later, I received an email from NARSL, and lo and behold, your podcast was highlighted in that email newsletter. So I went to my favorite podcast app and downloaded the podcast and listened, and I've been listening ever since on my morning and evening commute. I can't thank both of you enough for the valuable information you are providing us PFRs. Your podcast has been very enlightening and informative. I've gotten so much value out of it, I even became a patron about 3 weeks ago. Thanks again for your time and effort that you put into the Registry Matters podcast. Now, off to go catch up on previous episodes, and until next time, FYP.
Larry, he became a patron and listens using a podcast app. I'm just so shocked.
I am as well, and he's very articulate.
And he used his voice memo on his phone to record it and send it, which is amazing, instead of using the crappy phone system.
Well, we don't have to worry about the phone. We haven't got one of those lately.
So we should, let's move over real quick that, you put out a listener challenge last week, to do what?
I wanted people to look at the bio a little bit. You could use the internet to look at Edwin Stanton's career and tell me what I would have found, because I found him to be an amazing guy. What would have attracted me to Edwin and his public service? And I figure someone would look at that and come up with something, but nobody did last week.
I guess nobody was around at your time to have any sort of personal interaction with Mr. Stanton to see what the comparison would be between the two of you.
Well, but there's a lot on the internet. I mean, and you can always believe Wikipedia, right? Everything on Wikipedia has to be correct.
I do have an opinion on this. You can trust it almost reliably that it's accurate, unless there's something hot and heavy going around, and they've put in so many controls since then, but George Bush had some entries changed to make him look like really a terrible, terrible, terrible person. And the edits were just going back and forth, adding and deleting. But now there are controls in place. As far as a resource for people to use that is in almost all of the languages that people use on the planet and all that, please trust it, but go verify it too. Don't just trust it implicitly. You should verify. At least, they're sightings. Go check sightings. That's where they got their information from. I think Wikipedia is phenomenal.
I do as well.
Let's see. Do you want to dive right in? Oh, let's talk about this, the screenshot that I have up there. We have the new service, the transcript. What is that picture up on the screen there for those watching the YouTubes?
That picture would represent the batch of transcripts that went out. Actually, I got about Thursday, but normally the intent is to have the previous episode out on Friday, and that would be 25 transcripts. And what we did was we took the patrons who have signed up for their loved ones, And then we took some people that have been loyal to Narsil that I thought might be interested, that we blended them in. And then we did some random selection to try to build the interest inside the institutions. And we used that same method to build the newsletter circulation from 100 to over 1,000 over the course of the last 4 or 5 years. So my intent is to send out a random selection of a couple dozen each episode. And hopefully that will cause people to reach out to their loved ones and say, wow, I didn't know about this podcast. Ma, you ought to sign up for it so I can get the transcript.
Do you think in your experience of sending things like this inside of institutions, will feedback eventually materialize? I mean, can we expect to hear something from someone at some point that they liked it, hated it, they think were garbage or were the best?
We're going to definitely hear from people in prisons. Since it's just so new, it's going to take a while. But we're going to hear feedback from people saying, wow, I didn't know it, or you people are nuts or whatever. But we'll get feedback. We did on the newsletter when I force-fed it. We don't have to do that anymore. There's enough. Its momentum carries itself. Now we have a little growth each month. But when I was forcing them out to people who had no idea we existed, we got positive, mostly feedback, and some people were not amused because they got a newsletter from an advocacy organization and they said it compromised their safety because it wasn't in an envelope.
Right, right. Yeah, I remember I remember somebody receiving something in Georgia that wrote back some pretty hateful stuff. You know what I'm talking about?
I do, but I'm wondering with this, you have to be, if anybody's old enough to remember the Evelyn Wood speed reading courses, you have to be a pretty fast reader at the time that the mail is handed out. If a news magazine, if the person can, if some people can read it and figure out what it is while you're taking it from the mail distributing officer, or if they have a mail officers, or is it usually the guards that hand out mail in prisons?
It is definitely guards. Oh my God, guards, oh. Yes.
Well, I thought they might have a male technician that went around, kind of like the way they do with sick call.
No, at least not in Georgia. They have the schleps that, I've had so many problems. I had to file a grievance against one of them for mispronouncing my name. And I claimed that it was like, I don't want to say it was racial discrimination, but it was ethnic discrimination because of my name. And I don't want to go into all that, but the person refused to pronounce my name. So I would start calling him officer, you know, something Dumbledore for, you know, pick up some kind of name. I filed a grievance against him. And that stopped immediately.
Fantastic. But yes, I do anticipate feedback probably as early as this coming week.
Really? That fast? I mean, it's only been, 3 weeks since we've been mailing them out?
Well, yes, but by 3 weeks, those people that have read them from cover to cover, and many people do have a lot of time and they read things cover to cover, I expect we're going to get feedback. I didn't know this makes sense, or you guys are nuts. You've got it all wrong, but yeah, I think we'll have our own little fan club and our own detractors that'll be writing to us at the podcast.
Of course. All right. Well, let's jump over into this first thing that you wanted to put on the agenda. It's Tennessee Reed versus Lee. Is that, so that's where we're going to head first?
That would be correct. That is something that is just very exciting to a lot of people. We've gotten more than one email, which is unusual when you get more than one email about something. But we've got a number of emails.
So this is dude against the state, the governor of Tennessee, which is William Lee. So Ronald Reed against William Lee, and he is asking for an injunction. Is that right?
That is correct.
So what is the status? Where are we at?
Well, he did the amazing. He actually got the injunction. So the status of the case right now is that the state of Tennessee is enjoined from enforcing its registration requirements against Mr. Reed, whose conduct predated any form of registration in the state of Tennessee.
How far back are we talking about for that?
Well,
in the 90s?
In the early 90s. His conduct dates back to 91, and Tennessee adopted in 94. Or 95 in the mid when the states were encouraged to 94 actually when the states were encouraged after the feds passed the Jacob Wetterling Act and encouraged the states to enact registries.
Let me go off the script just real quick. How is it that you could determine that someone doesn't, like, so his stuff predates the enactment of all of these harsh, terrible things, he's still a human, isn't he? Like, all of these things that apply to him that make his life miserable would apply to someone that gets convicted of it tomorrow. How do we have person is different than person?
Well, I don't know if we are saying that a person is different than a person. What we're saying with the type of challenge is being asserted, there are many different grounds which registration can be challenged. One of the most common is the ex post facto clause, because you can't increase punishment after the event. People have to have fair notice of what will be the repercussions of their conduct. So in this particular case, if I were advising Mr. Reed, I would see no reason to challenge it on any other ground other than the ex post facto clause, because to me that would be the lowest hanging fruit. I wouldn't want to go off on things that where there's not a lot of case law to support you, when there's a whole body of case law that's developed in terms of the ever escalating reach of registration has evolved what may have been a regulatory scheme to become punishment. So I would say that was the most logical choice for him to make in his circumstances, but it doesn't mean that it couldn't be punitive to someone else that's whose crime didn't predate the registry. It's just that was the best challenge for him.
And he doesn't want to try and push that big rock up the hill. And I mean, would that, I mean, I guess an injunction is different than him suing. Is that fair?
No, that's not fair. What he did, he filed the lawsuit, and then as a secondary request, he asked for injunctive relief, which is immediate relief. And he filed for the injunction to stop the harm that's occurring prior to the case moving through the judicial process. And an injunction is merely an award of something that you haven't won in court yet. You have not, the case hasn't been tried on the merits, but you're getting preliminary relief in advance of your case going to trial.
Okay. So you said that's why don't all challenges request an injunction?
That's a good question. It's because the burden is so high to get an injunction. You have to show, there's like four components. To me, the two most important are that you have to show that the case law that's already built on this area will guide you to victory when your case finally goes to trial. And you have to show without the injunction that irreparable harm will flow. And irreparable harm cannot be speculative. You have to show the irreparable harm will flow if the court doesn't grant the injunction. Then there's two other, one of the other ones is that's not adverse to the public interest. And I forget what the fourth one is, but the two most important, he was able to meet that. A lot of litigants are not able to meet that. For example, in the International Megan's Law Challenge, prior to the implementation of the process, people were saying that heads were going to be chopped off, but there haven't been any chopped off yet that I'm aware of. That all the horrible things that people said would happen in these foreign countries was there was a lot of speculation that these things would happen, and you can't speculate. An injunction has to prevent an inevitable harm that directly flows from the issue at hand, and you can't use it to bootstrap all your other claims that you'd like to assert, because the harm has to flow from this particular thing.
And as I recall, in another high profile case, for our people, was that there couldn't have been any harm demonstrated yet because the harm didn't exist yet, so the injunction was denied?
Injunctions are more often denied than granted. I'm not sure which one you're talking about, but in the state of Tennessee, there was an injunction granted just in the last year and a half with the law that they passed to rip families apart. You remember that you couldn't live with a minor child, even if it was your own family?
So.
Yeah,
right.
that one, there was an injunction because the harm was readily apparent. If there's a law that says you can't live with your minor child, the harm that flows from that is not speculative. If you can't be a parent and you can't interact with your kid, we don't need to speculate on that. That's harmful. Everybody agrees with that. So that was one where an injunction was granted. And I don't know the status of that particular case, but that was also in Tennessee. And they were trying to stop the flood from coming from Alabama, where they have a similar law.
Why do you think that Reed won this challenge?
I think he won it because of the inability of the state of Tennessee to contain themselves with
that's
the
funny. They can't help themselves, as you would say.
They really can't. They can't help themselves because they have the law enforcement apparatus asking for new tools, and they have the victims advocates apparatus asking for these things, and nobody has bothered to tell the law enforcement apparatus that if you want to keep this toy that you have where you can go out and bother people and harass them, we have to keep this toy relatively tamed, because otherwise it will trip over a constitutional threshold and the toy will not be available to you. And nobody bothers to tell the victims advocates that, because it's not politically popular to say that. When they bring in 100 people, and I think that our Maryland counterpart, if she's on tonight, could, I don't think that's much of an exaggeration. When I was in Maryland, there was probably close to 100 people in that witness room that the victims' advocates had brought into a committee hearing. It's very hard for a person who's in public office being live streamed around the state and around the globe, for that matter, to tell the victims' advocates, even though you would feel good if we did this, we can't do it because it would probably be unconstitutional, and then we risk losing the registration scheme. Nobody's going to say that. And that's what happened in Tennessee. That's what happened in Tennessee. I clipped from the decision. There's a lot of we can post this. I did not write this, folks. I made some slight edits and tried to make it so it was more understandable. But this is stuff that I just clipped from the opinion. And it starts with in 94, the Tennessee Assembly created a registry, and it talks about how the registry was relatively benign. It says that that a person convicted of the offense was required to register by paper within 10 days of release without supervision from probation, parole, or incarceration. The information on the registry was generally considered confidential, but it could be released. And then after 10 years, the registrant could petition orders removal. And then in the ensuing decades, the Tennessee General Assembly repeatedly, this is from the decision, returned to the sexual offender registration status to change whom they reached, what they required, and how much protection they offered the registered offender's privacy. And then they just couldn't stop themselves. And so Tennessee General Assembly continued their pattern of expanding the requirements of the registration regime by amendment. And then it lists what they did in 2008. 2010, 2011, where they added entering schools, playgrounds, and then they added libraries, residency restrictions. They just couldn't help themselves. And therefore,
that's no different in any state, though. I mean, it's not like one state said, oh, hey, here's the bare minimum. We like it. We're just like everybody piles on. Some just do it worse, sir, than others.
Well, that would be true. But you hit the tripwire in Tennessee because you have the Doe versus Snyder decision in Michigan, which they relied on because the analysis that was done in Doe versus Snyder, which is also blended into this cheat sheet, that explains how they came to their decision. The Snyder court found that there's a point of no return when a registry is inflicting punishment. Tennessee would have been okay if they'd have just kept this guy registering by a piece of paper, sending it in, and not imposing any restrictions on him. But you guys in Tennessee, you can't help yourself. and now you're back to square one because this is going to cause you untold litigation. The floodgates are going to open. And, of course, I think that means that there's a good chance that Tennessee will appeal this. Oh, I forgot I'm not supposed to say that. I think there's a good chance that the Tennessee will take an appeal on this injunction because they will not want the floodgate. If I'm an attorney in Tennessee, and now that there's been an injunction granted for a person whose conduct predates any type of registration in Tennessee, I'm going to be filing an action as quickly as the client can pay. And I'm going to say that this is a no-brainer, folks.
But I mean, to make the comparison, someone in chat brought up the injunction in Georgia. Like, I mean, that sheriff is going, I'm going to take this all the way to the Supreme Court if I have to. Okay, well, that could be really good. And that would make a blanket thing across the country. This could go that way too. Yes or no? Am I being too optimistic to say that if they appeal it and it goes to that level and the next level and all that, that it could then really strike a blow to all of them?
Well, your logic is not completely flawed except for one regard. It's actually sound except for this is already predicated on a Sixth Circuit decision, and the Supreme Court has already declined to review the Doe's versus Snyder case in Michigan. Since this is so similar to what they declined to review, unless there's been a dramatic change in the makeup of the Supreme Court, it would be unlikely they would want to review this again. So I would doubt that the Supreme Court would take it, and I would doubt that Tennessee would file a cert petition. Now, they could very well go to the Sixth Circuit and say, you know, you guys, you looked at this, and our registration is different here in Tennessee, and they would try to distinguish what makes theirs less punitive than Michigan's, and they would try to get a panel. They would draw a different panel of judges, and they would try to get a different panel to come up with a different outcome by distinguishing their arguments. I think you lose on that. But what it does do is it stalls, and they would ask what they would do is ask the Sixth Circuit to put a block on this Reed character from getting any relief. They would say to put a hold on the injunction and let us continue to enforce the registry while this appeal goes forward. And it's just a delaying tactic. And ultimately, I think the panel would not, they generally don't overturn another panel unless there's a significant alteration in what the facts are. And I don't see it in this. The Tennessee registry looks an awful lot like Michigan's to me.
Okay, so you know, build a matrix. So take Excel or, you know, pick your tool of choice, and you're right. Try and figure out to normalize the language of, you know, living restrictions or no parks or all the different things, and try to normalize the language, because one state's going to say you can't operate a motor vehicle, but another one's going to say you can't drive a car. So normalize the language and figure out which states have the worst ones and where challenges have been applied. Like, you know, in this thing, the guy is talking about that he can't go and participate in his school functions, seeing his kids graduate from the various grades. Like, all of us are dealing with that. I don't see how, you know, for Michigan and Tennessee to have this struck down for this one dude, it doesn't apply to somebody in California that has the same thing. I don't see how. I understand that they're different states, but I still don't really see how it's different.
Well, in terms of there are a lot of states that don't have any restrictions on terms of what and the registry. A lot of these restrictions arise from probationary supervised parole, and the supervising authorities are imposing these conditions. But where these things are imposed as a condition of registration, they're definitely vulnerable to challenge, unless, of course, you're in the Fifth Circuit, which is a horrible circuit based in New Orleans. And that encompasses Texas, and everything that goes to the Fifth Circuit seems to not gain any traction. But you're correct that these ever evolving encroachments are very similar, and they're vulnerable to attack. We just need more money, more resources, and we're going to have to get more challenges going around the country, and the cases have to be properly built. And this guy did it correctly. He filed the right cause of action, and he didn't try to do it in a criminal case. He did it the correct way.
Didn't do it pro se.
Didn't do it pro se.
Does that mean that attorney is now under the radar of Narsal to tap to do other work?
It would be if we knew who it was. I haven't done the research to figure out who the attorney was, sure. Who the attorney is. But all the Tennessee people, I'm sure that we'll have an email as soon as this podcast goes out telling us the name of the attorney, because I can assure you people in Tennessee are tuned into this, and they know who the attorney is.
Brenda said she listed a bunch of states and said, but the other states nobody has challenged. So, I mean, that goes with what you just said about it. So we need people to formulate logical, coherent challenges in states looking for these kinds of infractions. What did you just call them? What did you just call them a second ago?
You expect me to remember what I said a second ago?
I do, actually. But anyway, so overstepping boundaries, whatever, making it hard to live. And maybe we could push back and gain some sort of semblance of realistic living.
Well, one other thing I'd like to add in this is toward the end of the cheat sheet where there's the red highlights about the restrictions on Halloween.
Okay.
I've had conversations with Tennesseans for a few years, including an attorney from Tennessee who shall remain nameless because I'm going to be critical of the attorney. And I told the attorney and the Tennesseans, I cannot find these restrictions anywhere in the Sex Offender Registration Act. that the Department of Corrections were imposing on people. They were just telling everybody, you have to be home. They were treating everyone on the registry as if they were a supervised offender. Well, finally, this judge points out that these restrictions are nowhere in the act, and that the enforcement of these restrictions on Reed was a mistake by the Metropolitan Police, whatever that city was that, that was enforcing those. But this was a mistake. I keep telling folks, this is an important point. When the police tell you you have to do something, sometimes they're telling you something that you don't have to do, because it has to be in statute. If you're not under supervision, now your supervising authorities can tell you to do some things that are not in statute. But when you're when you've paid your debt to society and they tell you that you have to do something, it's not unreasonable to say, well, I'm not familiar with that section of the statutory scheme. Can you cite to me where it says I have to do that? And if they tell you, well, you know what goes for you best for you if you do this, life will go better, say, well, I understand that's your position. But my position is life goes better as an American if we don't succumb to doing things that we're not required to do. And I'd be happy to do it if you can show me where I'm required to do this. This is something where I've said for years, if you're not under supervision, you don't have to do this. When they file a criminal complaint against you, they have to be able to cite to jurisdiction of the court, which they have to prove that the infraction occurred within the jurisdiction of the court. And they have to cite to a section of law that you're in violation of in order for the person who's accused to be able to figure out how to defend themselves. And if you can't cite to a section of law that says you're required to do this or you're prohibited from doing that, the person can't defend themselves. So if a person, if the police were to file a criminal complaint, and if a lax judicial official were to sign an arrest warrant and they were to haul you into custody, the first motion your attorney would make would be, you would stipulate that you did exactly what was in the complaint. Yes, the lights were on Halloween. Yes, he did hand out candy. And there's nothing in the statutory scheme of the state of Tennessee that prohibits the person from doing that. Therefore, this court must dismiss. And that's what would happen.
It would just be like, we've erased it. We use whiteout like this. Not that it never happened, but like, screw the prosecutor. Like, you guys are idiots. Go home.
Well, they would, you'd still have the arrest record, and I can't vouch for what the bond would be set for. I know that that's a consideration. No one wants to be arrested and handcuffed and hauled to jail, and no one wants to have to spend their financial resources. But if it's not in the statute, they can't convict you, and I shouldn't say can't. They shouldn't be able to convict you of breaking a non-existent law.
This feels like an organization that I follow, where they send very threatening letters to organizations that are explicitly violating laws and under threat of lawsuit, and generally they back down. I mean, you know, kind of like the Spalding and the Butts County. It's like, hey, you don't have the authority to do this. One of them backed down, one of them didn't.
That would be correct.
Don't we get the Narsal attorneys to write letters saying, hey, this is coming, back down? I mean, there's nothing, you know, how do you prove a negative? There's nothing in the law that says that you can do this. Back down. You will lose.
I wish that I had an attorney in Tennessee that we could have done that with, but the attorney I was relying on was adamant that, that you had to do it, but yet there wasn't anything in the statutory scheme that, that supported that. So now we have resolved that issue, because the federal judge, which his or her, I don't know if this is a male or female, but his or her legal resources are far greater than what mine are, and the federal judge is saying it's not there. So I'm going to take the federal judge's word for it.
Fair. Judge Aletta A. Trauger? That's what I'm going to go with.
And what's the gender of that judge?
I got nothing on that one. I do not know. Are we done with that? Should we move on?
We should move on.
And very good. So this someone brought this up in chat just before we began, and this is the AWA proposed regulation changes. Is that what this is?
That is.
All right. I have like no idea what's going on here.
Well, as Nancy, no, that wasn't Nancy that said that. It was Ronnie that said that. Well, Nancy.
Yeah, he was all about some wells. Well.
In order to implement the Adam Walsh Act, there have been a series of regulations issued, and there's a process that goes for public comment, which I submitted comments on the last round, not the last round, but on the first round of the AWA, I think in 2008, I submitted comments. But these are merely proposed regulations that are out for comment for 60 days, I believe it is. And then after the comment period, they will be adopted and become final. They'll be published in the Federal Register. And what I have deduced from looking through this is that the concern is a little overblown, but not completely. There's reason to be concerned, but there's not reason enough for panic.
Okay, and I don't have a cheat sheet for this one. So why reason for concern, but not panic?
Well, the feds cannot create a federal registry. They realize that, and if you read through the 93 pages, they acknowledge that, and they've acknowledged that from the get-go. That's why they've asked the states to do it, and that's why they have used the treasury, the purse, to encourage it. When I say there's no federal registry, conceivably there could be a federal registry for people who have federal convictions, and that would be the family of the federal apparatus. That would be anything that's a federal crime, anything that occurs on Indian land that's not a minor crime, those end up in federal court. That would be the military convictions. There would be those where they could conceivably create a federal registry. But what you would have would be a federal registry that would be separate from the state registries, because the people who were convicted entirely within the state, there's no federal jurisdiction for them to create a registration obligation for them, where they would have to report to a federal registrar. They broke the laws of the state of Georgia, and Georgia determined that they wanted to register them. So therefore, there's no jurisdictional hook for them. And
okay.
So therefore, you would have a federal registry operating side by side with a state registry, and that would be duplicative. If there's any such word, that would be duplicating effort. You would have no reason for that when the states already have a registry. So the federal law just requires you that you register with your state officials. But where this is really, really problematic is that they have decided that their attempt is to clarify the regulations that the states are operating within. And the states, if they're as clever as I expect they will be, and I will guarantee you that I'm not letting any secret out of the bag, there are people that work in the registration schemes across the country in law enforcement. They're every bit as clever as I am, if not more clever. So they're going to pick up on this. What they've done here is they've opened the door for the states to not have to actually adopt all these provisions one by one, all the things that it takes to be federally compliant. They can simply do it with a blanket statement that a person has to comply with the federal, for example, the time frame. Rather than saying how long a person has to register and prescribing that in state law, they could totally eliminate their state reference to how long a person registers, and they would say that the person would register consistent with the terms established by the AWA and by federal law. They could do that in terms of the reporting obligations that your reporting frequency will be consistent with what is required by the federal standards. Your 3-day window for most reporting of additional registration or changes. They could simply say that these things will be consistent with the federal standards, and then they can bow out of the legislating business and simply say that they're adopting the federal standards. And there's where the danger lies, because if they're able to move that type of proposal through their legislative process, then all of a sudden, de facto, you will have the Adam Walsh Act adopted without actually going through the nuances of putting all these tiering level of your offenses, because that's the complexity, one of the complexities of trying to figure out how the offenses align With you look at a state statutory scheme and trying to figure out it, most states have gotten it wrong. They've over-tiered things that didn't need to be. And once in a while, they've under-tiered something. Most of the time, they've over-tiered something. And you would end up with the feds, by regulatory fiat, they would tell the state, these crimes are 15, these are 25, or these are life. And since the state has passed a law saying that they're going to incorporate the federal requirements as theirs, then that's the danger. But it doesn't create a new jurisdiction unless the state wants it to. If the state does what we do, which we beat everything that comes in, if we continue to beat back everything that comes in, it doesn't change anything. It doesn't change one iota of what would be required by New Mexico unless New Mexico changes its own law. But that's what I fear, that they will do that across the country.
So they just say, see federal guidelines, blah, 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 and now we're compliant.
That's what I'm afraid that they will do. And then in these proposed regulations, they acknowledge, I think on page 11, I put a highlight on the 93 pages, they acknowledge quite well that this is something, if I could read on the podcast, it says, this reflects the fact that SORNA provides minimum national standards for sex offender registration. It is intended to establish a floor rather than a ceiling for the registration programs of states and other jurisdictions, which can prescribe registration requirements binding on sex offenders under their own laws, independent of SORNA. See, they're acknowledging that the states can do whatever they want to do. Jurisdictions accordingly are free to adopt more stringent or extensive registration requirements for sex offenders than those set forth in this part, including more stringent or extensive requirements regarding where, when, and how long sex offenders must register and what information they must provide and what they must do to keep their registrations current. Well, conversely, you can also adopt less, which some states have. But when people write and call and leave messages saying that, well, this violates federal law, no, it doesn't. The federal law is a recommended minimum to be awarded that precious designation of substantially AWA compliant. It doesn't preclude the states from doing things beyond that, including registering offenses that are not recommended, which every state practically that I've looked at registers indecent exposure, not required. We just talked in the previous segment about residency restrictions, not required. We talked about proximity restrictions, not required. We talked about exclusions from school activities, not required. All this stuff that your states have done, not required by the federal SORNA.
It all, like, just a few pages prior to where we just were, it says, this statement will make it easier for sex offenders to determine what they are required to do and thus facilitate compliance. Larry, this is for us. This is working to our benefit.
I struggled with that one. I was going to text Attorney General Barr, but it seems like he's changed his number.
Surprise!
But the concluding part of my point, they've recognized in here that states that don't adopt these things, like for example, the 3-day window of reporting changes, if the state has a 10-day window, or I think there might be a state out there that has still a 10-day window. I know we do. Oh, there might be another state other than us that has a 10-day window. And in our instance, we have sheriff's offices that aren't open to registrants but once a week. And some, I think we might even have one that's open every couple of weeks. But we have, well, they say that the sex offender, the PFR, if they can't comply with that, say, for example, if New Mexico said you would register in compliance with federal standards, and they would get that blanket part of the books. And we've got a sheriff's office that still only opens once a week. Well, that would not permit you to come in within 3 days, which allows, under these guidelines, the PFR can assert that as an affirmative defense. Well, it was impossible for me to comply. So they recognize that you still can't force a state to do what it's not going to do.
Yeah.
So I want people to understand that. This doesn't force any state to do anything that they're not inclined to do. But what this does do is this gives the states an easy way to do something that the victims' advocates and the law enforcement apparatus will encourage them to do, which means you better get your legislative advocacy in gear after these are adopted, because the logical thing they would do would be to change their statutory scheme to say that we abide by federal law. And then all of a sudden, all this stuff is a moot discussion.
I see. God, that 10-day thing. So, like, you could be arrested and held, and then you'd be like, yes, but I couldn't comply. I'm like, oh, crap, we're sorry. Hey, we're going to open the doors for you. I like, that just sucks, Larry.
Well, but again, this is where I maintain that only the state could arrest you. So I'm giving the benefit of the doubt that the state officials here might actually know the law. And I know that's a stretch, but I'm assuming that a county sheriff here would not seek an arrest warrant on the 3-day rule if they weren't open. Now, I may be giving them too much credit, but I just don't believe that. And the feds do not have, in my opinion, this is my opinion, they don't have the authority to do the arrest because you haven't violated federal law. You violated state law. There is no federal registry.
Now you violated federal guidelines.
Until New Mexico says that you have to register within 3 days, it doesn't make a damn what the feds say about how often or when you have to register, because this is our dog and pony show here.
Do you think that this makes it easier to mount a nationwide challenge instead of trying to piecemeal it state by state?
It's not coming to me at first glance, but if a lot of states were to adopt the blanket language and say we're just going to go by the feds, and I don't see that happening overnight, but if a lot of states did that, possibly. But even if they did, we still have 50 separate registration schemes.
Right. Oh, God, like there's no way. And we could just immediately like go right back to it's like you were bringing up the food inspector thingamajiggers for restaurants. Like every state probably has some sort of different food handling requirements. And so if you don't comply, they just shut down. You know, that's what a civil regulatory scheme looks like. But unless you've got cockroaches and actually like poisoning people, I don't think there are criminal charges for not complying.
Oh, come again with that? You don't think there are criminal? There absolutely are criminal charges for not complying.
No, that's what I mean. But like, if people are dying from it, then yes. But if you have if you have somewhat dirty silverware, you're probably not going to get locked up for having dirty silverware. They're going to dock you and close you like for a week maybe until you fix it, and then you go back to business.
You are correct. On a first-time violation for a health thing, depending on the severity of it, there are immediate closures. So if you watch our city of Albuquerque public health, we have our own city inspections here. I think we're the only city in the state that does. But there are occasionally immediate closures. But if you continue to not make the corrections and you continue to defy that, they will lock you up.
But I mean, if you have someone that fails to register once, it's, you know, 1 5-year kind of sentences, like right off the bat for something that you possibly didn't necessarily know exactly, like, hey, you were a day late, like F you, cuff up, we're taking you in. Like, they're not doing that to the restaurant necessarily. Not like that. It's not that heavy handed.
You are correct. They treat this as more of a public safety issue than they do food. Now, I don't know that I agree with that. I think people get sick all the time from bad food and from lax practices in restaurants. But to say it's not criminal, it very well could be criminal. But as a general rule, how you're going to be treated is quite a bit different. And if you violate the registry in most states, it's a serious misdemeanor. It's a felony in most states, but if there's a state left where it's a misdemeanor, it's still a serious misdemeanor. At our state, it's a felony of a fourth degree that carries a potential period of incarceration of 18 months. So it's not like a city of Albuquerque restaurant inspection where you can get up to 90 days, I think, on most municipal ordinances. So you've got 90 days versus 18 months looking at you. But you can go to jail for violating the restaurant rules. Another thing to point out in this is that this recognizes that there are jurisdictions that don't register certain offenses, even though the feds would like them to be registered because their law doesn't cover that. And they acknowledge that the state doesn't have to register you, but if they say if that state is willing to register you, you need to register. So what I see this doing is that the states are going to be willing to register more people if they adopt that blanket provision that anything is defined as a sex offender, because that would make people like Regina in our state really happy, because then it would neuter our equivalent that it has to be an equivalent offense. Regina would just say, well, we define a sex offender as anybody that is in the Adam Walsh Act as a sex offender. So therefore, we don't have to do that analysis anymore. It's irrelevant whether it's equivalent, because we have the catch-all that says, so therefore we're willing to register you. That's the real danger in this.
Okay. Any other closing comments before we move on?
I hope that some of these national organizations will take this seriously and express their shock and dismay at these proposed regulatory changes. And having said that, I don't expect it to work like none of the other ones have, but at least you get it on the record that this is not the way to go. And this might be an opportunity for the national organizations to collaborate in terms of putting forth something to the Department of Justice, saying how bad this is.
Larry, let me bounce this by you before we move on. Going on a chat, I was trying to figure out how to like actually present this, but it didn't seem super concise. So I'll just read what was written. It says, "What I'm especially concerned about is in retro, like Pennsylvania changed their scheme for 2012 and before, which I fall under, that they will take that away along with other challenges being done in the court, like in Michigan." Does that tell you anything that you can speak to?
I don't really have that fear. I don't see them being able to undo. Remember, this is all off the cuff with having a small amount of preparation here. But the punitive nature of those decisions were decided based on ex post facto. Now, I'm not saying that they couldn't require you to register. But I don't think they can build back the registry that they had pre-litigation because those facts don't change. In Michigan, the 2006 and 2011 enhancements made that those requirements to register too punitive to be applied retroactively. And I don't think you could undo that with any proposed regulation. Same thing goes in Pennsylvania. You know, I don't see that as being something to be fearful of.
Let me try and explain it in my dumb person terms. So I believe that Pennsylvania challenged the 1,000-foot kind of living restrictions at some point and won it. Those aren't in these recommendations to begin with. So fighting like them just saying we're going to blanket follow these. Well, that was already something that got struck down as being beyond and not constitutional. So they're not going to like roll any of those kinds of things back in.
Well, I'm not sure there was a proximity issue in Pennsylvania. I don't think they had any restrictions on living. We got a Pennsylvanian in chat. We can, but you are correct. There are not. The federal law does not encourage or require or suggest that there be restrictions placed on where people live or work. These are inventions that you have done in your states of your own volition.
And find all of those parks, schools, playgrounds, like proximity, any of that stuff, all of these extra things that make life so much more challenging. Even like, actually, I mean, this might not be a terrible time to talk about. I had a pretty long conversation with someone on Twitter about, they challenged what I said last week about the register, like what's so bad about it. And they were like, are you serious? What's so bad about it? I was like, hang on. Like the registry, the act of it. I'm not saying that's a good thing to go to the popo and go hang out and say, hey, you know, here's my fingerprints and people around with tasers. I'm just saying like the bad part is the internet. Having your junk posted about where you work, live, all that stuff, your picture. That's what is really, really over the top. Hard for people to overcome. Then your neighbors get involved. Like they know who you are. Like all that to me, the internet piece is the worst of the worst. Is that in this?
There is in the Adam Walsh Act. They do require for substantial compliance the internet publication of at least the tier 2 and tier 3 offenders.
Okay. So I mean that was like my like the crux of what I was even I was tongue in cheek asking it last week. I was trying to poke the bear, so to speak, about whether the registration like the registry is so bad, and our guest pushed back pretty hard. It's like, I don't want to be on it. Man, I get it. None of us want to be on it. But the problem is everyone having access to your information. Otherwise, yes, an employer is always going to do a background check, and whether you felony jaywalked, well, that's going to show up on your record. and all the way to these really terrible crimes that people do commit, those are also going to show up. But it's the public access that when you go to a sports game, you know, for your little league team, that the neighbors and all that stuff are poking, like, oh, there he is over there. Like, that's what gets you, like, makes life really hard to live. To me, in my opinion.
Well, I would agree. It also sets up the vigilante stuff. That
correct. Yeah, 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 yeah. Totally.
The you could actually do. Listen to me closely, law enforcement. You could actually do a website if you would let go of your desire to put non-conviction rated information on there. Where they're living is not conviction related, so you'd have to drop that. What they drive was not conviction related, so you'd have to drop that. Where their work at is not conviction related, you would have to drop that. And I can go on and on. But if you merely wanted to put the name of the offense they were convicted of and the photograph as it existed at the time of conviction, nothing else is related to the conviction. How they age is not related to the conviction. If you wanted to just do that, you could probably get away with that indefinitely as long as you didn't put stuff on there that had nothing to do with conviction. But you can't help yourself because that's not what you want. You want them to not to be ostracized from their neighbors. You want them to feel threatened when they're in their cars driving, to be attacked. You want all these things, and I know you're rolling your eyes that I'm actually telling you that. You and the victim's advocates, you want all these things to happen to these people because you hate them so bad. Your hatred is what overcomes you. If you merely just wanted a registry of a list of people who had these convictions and you didn't do anything else with it other than compile the information on conviction day, you could probably get away with that in perpetuity. Constitutionally, I'm talking about, not in terms of it being a good public policy. Constitutionally, I don't think that would be vulnerable to any challenge.
I understand your points. But they can't help themselves, as you say. HEP? Is that how you would spell that one?
They can't help themselves because they have enormous pressure from the people that I just named, and they don't have hardly any pushback from the PFRs, and the organizations that represent PFRs are woefully underfunded and generally not present. And that really makes it a one-sided discussion. And that's the problem.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible. Okay, and you put something in here, like a little intro about something. I'm not sure if you wanted to actually cover this piece. Its client is released on probation terms, include no contact with complainant. Did you want to go over that?
Oh, yeah, that was something on the National Criminal Defense Lawyers listserv. I thought it was funny, as I say.
Okay. Do you want me to just like read it and then you can respond to it?
Sure, that'd be good.
All right, so the client is released on probation. Terms include no contact with the complainant. He commits another offense, different complainant, and is incarcerated pending his VOP, which is violation of probation hearing. While in jail, the complainant from case one, the one where the no contact order came up, contacts him by letter, wants closure. Man, that's almost like entrapment. Like, you can't stop the person from mailing you. She sets up a Securus account, accepts calls from him, and the recorded conversations show them trying to work things out. Prosecutor finds out about the recorded calls from corrections and wants to also violate DF, defendant?
Yep.
On the calls. Eventually, they decided to proceed to violate him on only these calls. Trial attorney says, hey, shouldn't probation end when one is in jail, can't comply with many conditions, including association with other criminals and finishing programs? Yeah, that would be interesting. Like, it says no association with criminals, but they put you in a box where there are other criminals. Prosecutor says, okay, fine, logically we could violate him for things beyond his control, but he called her in violation of the order. Anyone have case law about whether you can violate probation while in jail? That is an interesting question, Larry.
Well, and I thought it was, that's why I put it in, and the answer is going to amaze you. You can actually we do know. We absolutely do know that. We absolutely do know that. You can violate your probation while you're in jail. You absolutely can do that.
Because in jail, you're just being detained like you're, Well, how would you classify the person in jail, quote unquote, detained? You're not convicted of anything. You're just not free. You're certainly not going out to watch movies and a popcorn on your own.
Well, now he is convicted. The crime that has him on probation, he is convicted. Now he's picked up a new charge. Now that formed the basis for a presumed violation. An arrest on the new charge is presumptively a violation. So therefore, they took him into custody, which is common. And then while you're in custody, your probation hasn't been revoked yet. So conditions still apply. Your probation is running until it's revoked, even though you're in jail.
Well, I guess that's good for counting down time, too.
Yes, so your probation is running, and you are in custody awaiting a disposition of the technical violation, which in this case, it was more than a technical violation. It was a new charge. And in some cases, the state will go ahead and defer resolution of the PV until the new charge is resolved, because then they've got clear and convincing proof if you plead or if you get convicted. But in this particular case, they had all the convincing evidence they needed, because on recorded line, now just as a general rule for those who are reading the podcast in prison, they record those calls that you talk on in prison.
Yeah, they tell you they're going to record them. Don't give me that crap. That's like, hey, this call is being recorded.
And the person who was on probation, yet to be revoked, they had a duty to abide by the terms of probation of that no contact order. Now, granted, she reached out. We're taking everything at face value. She reached out to him. Fine, you can't control that. The mail comes, they hand it out to you, and what you would do is you would say, put this person on a do not contact list and do not distribute any more mail to me. And then when she sets up the Securus line and requests a phone call, you don't make that phone call. So what that tells the court is that if you're in custody and you can't follow the restrictions of no contact, what would be the likelihood you could follow them on the outside world? If he did anything to himself, he set himself up for a revocation, in my view.
Yeah, totally. Totally, totally. Oh, boy. Okay, so, you know, so some of the people that go to prison aren't necessarily the brightest bulbs in the Christmas tree.
Well, now we just lost our whole prison subscription list now because of what I just said.
Oh, sorry. Except for you guys reading this, you obviously are smarter than the average batch. Got it. Okay, so that should have at least cleared some of that up, right?
It's counterintuitive. But in my view, and I don't know if I'll be able to follow this if it'll get on the listserv, in my view, that is a bona fide violation of probation.
Sure.
It would withstand constitutional challenge. Any appeal would be denied. You had a no contact order. And when they put you on probation, if you didn't like that no contact, you should have told them, I will not accept a no contact order, and they will have an alternative program for you.
I gotcha. Hey, we got some articles to cover. Oh, wait, we gotta acknowledge a message from one of our patrons. This is one of our super duper duper over the top, awesome, very generous patrons from Tennessee. And you wanted to acknowledge him in some form or fashion. What did you want to say?
Yes, Justin, thank you for the email. I am super swamped because of the pandemic, but I do intend to reach out to you in response. And we're going to set up the consultation. The Narsil has me doing two jobs right now.
You should quit.
Well, I know, especially with view of all the money that they pay me. I've had, believe it or not, more inquiries recently from people who want consultative services, which I do for attorneys. So I'm getting more private pay work, and I've just not had as much time to spare. Plus, I'm old and tired.
Are you saying that you need more than 24 hours in a day, Larry?
I actually do have more. Have you looked at my clock? I've got to turn on my camera so you can see my clock. I actually have a 28-hour clock.
Oh, outstanding. Actually, but I do want to point out that at a certain tier level, like you, that is one of the perks is to gain access to have a private chat with Larry about whatever you want to talk about, whether that be politics or something about your case. And that is at the $50 a month level. And just wanted to throw that out there.
And just be clear, it's not legal advice because I have to be under the supervision of an attorney, but it is consultative advice. Yeah. And oftentimes we do find some situation where it would behoove the person to arrange an attorney, which I am delighted to work with if they find a competent attorney. And so it helps in figuring out if they have an issue that needs to go towards an attorney. When we finish talking, the person is better prepared to discuss. They know what to say to the attorney, and they know what the attorney should say to them if the attorney is qualified. And it helps the person. It empowers them when they know what the issues are.
I do understand. Let's see here. Okay, so we do have a couple articles to cover, so we're going to knock these out really quick, and we can get out of here and call it an early night, Larry. We got a first one. You put one in here from NACDL News Releases. It says, National's Criminal Defense Bar welcomes new Title IX regulations, calls for the restoration of due process on campus is essential. Due process, what is that?
I put that in there only for one reason. It doesn't require a lot. The Trump administration, which is typically, I'm not in agreement with much of their agenda. This is something I do agree with, and I can't help myself. I've said several times that we need due process for people who are accused of crimes. It's an amazing concept, but it's enshrined in our Constitution, and I'm glad to see it returning to the college campuses. Or is it campi? Which is it?
Campuses.
I'm glad to see it returning to the colleges, and I agree with this, and I'm glad to see that a reputable organization like the National Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys agree. I agree with them. I'm glad to see they took this posture because we're in the defense business, and people are supposed to be presumed innocent. They're supposed to be afforded due process, and they're not supposed to be disallowed to be engaged in a process and be punished and extricated from campus and all these things that were happening to them without even seeing the evidence or being able to even think about knowing who their accusers are.
Yeah. It would be challenging, Larry. And I please understand that I get the innocent until proven guilty, that then tomorrow you go back into class and the person that allegedly that you believe did it is sitting there in class next to you. That would be very disruptive for you. I do want to at least acknowledge that would be a very challenging environment to be in.
I would acknowledge that as well. And those things can be dealt with through the existing infrastructure. We can do that with no contact orders. Now, I don't mind a no contact order, because that doesn't hamper the person's defense. It could impede their educational opportunity, but it doesn't hamper their defense. I resent the hampering and hamstringing of their defense. If you wanted to put a standard no contact, you can't be within 100 feet, then it's going to be the accused's problem to deal with that no contact order and figure out how they're going to work around that. They may have to drop a class, and they may have to do some things like that. I don't think you can ban them from the campus altogether. But you can put some distance between the person, and certainly you would want to fashion the order so that it would be clear that the person sought the contact. We can't allow the alleged victim to go out of their way to find you on campus and say, oh, he had contact with me, or she had contact with me.
Sort of so, like the person in the jail cell setting up the securest thing to work things out.
Correct.
All right. So there's some good news of NACDL, and that's the National Association for Criminal Defense Lawyers, trying to help out with the Title IX stuff. Here's like a fun one that Con Air, I'm sure everyone, even you, Larry, probably have seen the movie Con Air, is spreading COVID-19 all over the federal prison system. They're still transporting prisoners around and they're not testing. Like, it's not that hard at this point to test if somebody has the COVIDs, the human malware. And it says U.S. Marshals are transporting prisoners without testing them for coronavirus. If we don't test, Larry, then the numbers would stay low because we don't know if they have it. That seems fair.
I don't see a problem with that logic. Now, Con Air, that would be Continental Airlines, right?
Yes, I'm sure that's exactly what Con Air stands for. Let's see. What other con words could we come up with? Converse? Like there's a shoe company. Anything else?
Well, I said that for a particular reason. I know what Con Air is, but I said that because I want someone in chat to do a Google. there's a former chief executive officer of Continental Airlines, a very, very fine chief executive officer. So this is not in any way a slight on him. But his name, I want you to Google Gordon Buffoon and tell me what comes up.
Yes, his name is, it's Gordon M-B-E-T-H-U-N-E, Buffoon.
Yeah, but okay. when you Google Gordon Buffoon, Google has had that search enough times that it comes up with Mr. Buffoon.
Oh, Buffoon. yes, it does. Were you searching for Gordon Buffoon?
No. So that tells me what little I understand about algorithms. Someone has searched didn't know how to spell his name, and they put in Buffoon, and Google figured out that they were talking about Gordon Buffoon.
I can explain it to you at some point if you'd like, Larry.
Well, am I close?
Yes. It's like when Google knows what results they deliver to you. And if you click on this other one, then they now know that you're typing in this thing wrong. And they say, oh, maybe you meant this instead. It's actually not that complicated. I wrote something for work similar to it.
But yes, Mr. Buffoon was a fine CEO. He was one like Southwest CEO. He would go work on holidays, do line work on the he felt like if you're going to ask the airline employees to come in on Christmas and Thanksgiving, that the executive team should be there as well. So he would come in on holidays and work alongside his team and show inspiration to them. And the original CEO of Southwest, Kelleher, his name was escaping me. He used to do the same thing.
Okay. So Con Air stands for Convict Air.
Right.
Why would it be so hard? Like, okay, I went somewhere today and they put a, it looked to me like the same like cooking thermometer that I have to test with the temperatures of the skillet. You know, it's just like a laser infrared thermometer, and they stuck that on my forehead and they said, okay, you can do what you got to do. I like, it's not that hard to do some really basic rudimentary checks on people. Even if you don't have the stick the thingamajigger down your throat to get the, you know, do the actual test.
Well, but you don't understand. We've got a prison system to run, and we've got to get these people in their assigned institutions, and we can't hold up progress because someone might have a fever, a slight fever, for God's sake. So, I mean, progress can't grind down to a halt. What's wrong with you?
I'm just thinking of the impact on the other side that you put 50 people on this plane, maybe something like that, and one person's got it, gal, and then they spread that to their 50 closest friends, and then they'll spread it to their 50 closest friends, and next thing you know, you have a pandemic. Oh, wait, we do have a pandemic. Oops, my bad.
Well, it's one of those things where how would the prisons operate if they couldn't move people around? I mean, I'm guessing they're still doing intake, putting people in prison. The courts are running at some level, and people are being classified, and they're being assigned to their institution. What are we going to do? Just halt everything?
No, but you know, you could put people on every other. You've flown. Did the plane that you flew a few months ago, did they have people separated out to some degree? Or
they
were at full capacity?
They had separation on Southwest. American was not as good about that. The American flights were pretty full. Very little separation. And Southwest was far better. They were not selling middle seats at that time. Now, and honestly, the middle seat's not going to protect you all that much.
No, I wouldn't think so. It'd be in between rows and whatnot.
But they were doing a PR gesture. And actually, we're going off on a tangent here. But I think it's funny. So I like going off on funny tangents. All right. So people are going to get an education about Eastern Airlines, the late defunct Eastern Airlines.
Didn't you say Continental?
Now we're going to Eastern. Eastern.
You're moving on to yet another tangent.
Tangent about this. Well, the reason why Southwest is doing this, I'm going to explain why Southwest is doing this. Southwest is doing this to pressure American. American is the weakest airline financially. Delta and Southwest are far stronger carriers. And they can take the revenue hits. Now, this is a complete reversal of what happened in 89, 90, particularly 90 when the Middle East War, when Saddam invaded Kuwait and travel collapsed. Saddam.
Yes. Saddam. Okay.
Saddam. So when Saddam invaded Kuwait, and we had a total collapse in travel, Eastern was already struggling, and Eastern was financially the weakest of the airlines. And the stronger carriers were at that time was American and Delta. And Delta really hit Eastern hard, particularly in the Atlanta hub. And they put $29 flights galore flying out of Atlanta, and they drove the coffin into Eastern Airlines. And that's exactly what is happening to American now, except the two stronger carriers is not American now. The two stronger carriers is Southwest and Delta, and they're doing everything they can to drive the nail in the coffin of American. And Americans having to respond with doing things that are contrary to their interests, like they can't afford to have empty seats. So they've announced that they're going back to full capacity. They've gone back to full capacity. And this is the chickens coming home to roost. Exactly what American did 30 years ago was being done to them. So that's what's funny, if you have a sense of humor. Yeah.
Funny, huh? You like using that term, funny.
Well, how else would you describe it?
I would describe it as, let's go on to this New York Times article.
All righty.
Which is also actually funny. It says, a Florida sheriff has ordered his deputies not to wear masks. The sheriff forbade his deputies from wearing masks while on duty, with some exceptions, and also barred visitors to his offices from wearing them. So I walk into the sheriff's office with a mask, and he says, take that crap off. And I'm going to be like, okay? Like, no, I'm still wearing it, you putz.
Well, I mean, even you, Andy, have to admit that's funny.
That's asinine. That is totally ridiculous, over the top. We should just move on.
Well, I'm surprised that he would be able to pull that off, because after we did our pre-show banter, I did a little bit of checking, and it's not exactly a rural county. I was thinking, well, maybe he could pull that off if he had a force of 12 deputies, but this is a county of 300,000 people, so you're not talking about a mom-and-pop operation. You're talking about a significant population. This is Ocala.
And that's a big jump.
And for him to be able to find a crew that would say, well, I'm going to be so loyal to you that I'm going to disregard my safety, my family's safety, and the safety of the citizens that I encounter. And not only that, it seems like it's counterintuitive. Maybe I'm out of tune with the politics in Ocala, Florida. Maybe the politics are different than what they are here. But it would seem like that this would irritate the citizens, that if you go to do police business and they say, you got to take that thing off before you come in here.
Yeah, like, you know, you go to a restaurant now, it says masks are mandatory, and the sheriff's office says no masks are mandatory.
So now how do you spell that for the transcriptionist? How do you spell what I just said? You got to take that off before you come in here.
Here, H-E, oh my God, that actually sounds like H-E-I-R. Yeah.
Oh.
Well, that's all of that. We do, I want to circle back just real quick, that one of the people in chat, just going back to the, talking about the AWA thing that we covered a minute ago, is that, this surmises the reason why the podcast exists. It says, okay, thank you all. Just making sure it wasn't an automatic thing. You all make me feel a great deal more at ease. From total distraught, I feel better now. See, we're helping people, Larry.
That is actually what we set out to do with this, is to help people. And in fact, I had one little announcement I wanted to make for, I'm reaching out to a person who reached out to me because I can't find your email. Someone reached out somehow to me about something, and I remember it came in the last week or 10 days, and the person said, I have broadcast experience. I can help you. I'm willing to be on. And they had a question. Please send that email again.
Right.
However, it
went through my filter and I missed it. Went directly to you. You're not able to find it. I don't know what it is.
Well, it may have been that they sent it to me directly, but I have looked high or low using every keyword I can find, and I intended to respond to it, and I can't find it. And I don't want to let someone down. And I think there was even a phone number in it. I think I was supposed to call them. But anyway, send it to me again. However you did it the first time, I obviously got it, or I wouldn't be mentioning it. So send it to me again. And this time I'll mark it unread, and I'll actually cut it and paste it and put it in the registry matters folder so that we don't lose it again.
All right. Well, you sent this to me, and you said, hey, this is kind of funny. This is a segment from... Oh, I don't want to do that. We'll get taken down if I play this. I got to play it with some muted. This is about, we're going to move on after this. We won't spend a lot of time here, but this is about an institution for troubled teens, like a disciplinary school, I suppose. The kid seems to be like throwing some food around. And can you then describe what happens after that, Larry?
Well, the way I would describe it, and it was actually difficult to watch, and it was on NBC Nightly News last night. So those of you who actually can still access the traditional newscast, that's where I got it. They swarmed him. The big burly staffers, they swarmed him and they smothered him until he quit breathing. And then they waited several minutes, was it 9, 10 minutes before they called 911 and said they had an unresponsive student?
Yeah, and, it's like 9 minutes.
And he was a cherubic guy, 16 years old, I think, they said. But if everybody that had thrown something at a cafeteria got smothered and suffocated to death when I was in school, I mean, it didn't happen continuously, but things got tossed. I tossed a milk carton. I remember I was thinking about, did I ever do? I think I tossed a milk carton. I was showing how what a good shot I was with a milk carton, and I tossed a milk carton, and I missed the trash can. And Coach Brandon said if we allowed that to go on, he said we'd have things flying all over the lunchroom, and I got sent to detention. I believe this was what it was. But this seems over the top, and I just think that it's such a sad thing that was the reaction for that level of misbehavior.
So pass a counterfeit bill, die, and throw some food in the lunchroom and die. I that's the pattern here. Got it. Is that characterized? Do you think I'm exaggerating the characterization there?
Well, I hope that there's justice for this. I think that they need to look at the school. The company said they had been revamping their policies in terms of restraint, and apparently the word didn't get out to this particular school. But I just don't see it. I know I'm probably a liberal do-good bleeding heart, but I just don't see this level of reaction for a 16-year-old kid.
It's crazy. Is there anything else that we can cover before we shut this down and move on? Looks like Larry wants to do another Patreon extra this week. So if you liked last week's Patreon extra, then awesome. If you would like to hear Patreon extras, then you could sign up over at Patreon. And I guess if you didn't like it, then don't listen to them. Is that fair?
And this one, I'll give you again, we're going to bash the Democratic Party.
But so we don't ever do that because you're a pointy head liberal do-gooder.
So if you like the Democratic Party being bashed, and believe me, this is sincere bashing. It's not because I know that the audience tends to be more conservative, but I feel strongly about the two things we're going to talk about. And so therefore, we're going to be talking about the Democratic Party.
All right. Larry, where can people find this program for them to download and listen to it?
It's on the internet.
On the internet, like the whole World Wide Web? Just would you DuckDuckGo? Would you use Bing? How about Ask Jeeves? Maybe you could go that route? Gopher?
Well, you can search using whatever search mechanism you have, or you could just go directly to registrymatters.co, and you will find it. But if you do a search for Registry Matters, it'll pop up on every engine that I've tried.
That is very correct. As far as I know, and as the person said in the voicemail message, they just fired up their trusty rusty podcast app and searched for it, and there it showed up. How about using the antiquated phone system where they call the operator and they ask to be connected to us?
That would be 747-227-4477.
And the email address that Larry never checks?
Well, that one doesn't come to me directly, I don't think. Registry Matters Cast. That's registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
And of course, we love all of our listeners, but especially our patrons. And how can people support the podcast directly?
Well, I was fishing for those stimulus checks that I thought was going to be coming. But I it's in the extra. We're not sure that that's something I'm going to say. I'm not so sure about now. But that would be www.patreon.com. And that's P-A-T-R-E-O-N.
Now, wait a minute. A couple episodes back, you said it was coming. I went and spent that money already.
You did? Well, I think you should ask for a refund from wherever you spent it.
Whoops. Well, Larry, I appreciate it as always, and I'll see you on the other side of the Patreon extra. Thank you so much. Have a great night.
Good night, everybody.